These last weeks, we have attempted to unearth and widen our understanding of Dr. King's deepest held theological convictions, or the ways in which his understanding of God's work in the world affected his work in the world. Something we all ought to reflect on every so often. As we sat together in staff meeting several months ago trying to bring this series to life, we began to realize that Dr. King's most famous speech might just be the thing to help us articulate together the foundational aspects of King's theology. So a little recap, just for the fun of it. The first week, we addressed the inherited problem, what one might call our original sin as a nation, what one might call the perpetual original sin of humanity, that is the devaluing, the exploitation, the terrorizing of certain lives in order to increase the power, wealth, and security of other lives. This inherited problem begins for us in America as slavery, and is repackaged over the centuries as Jim Crow, as mass incarceration, as fear-mongering about immigration, as a whole host of things, and it knows no ending. Yet. The second week, we acknowledged that this inherited problem demands of us a clarion response. Here, King follows the way of the prophets before him, the ones who called the problem what it was, and who refused to simply let the passivity of time and indifference hash out the details. Here we see King urgently demand action as he looks to the God of action. And then the third week, we pressed into King's vision for humanity rooted in his understanding of a universal God loving us universally. Here he acknowledges that the inherited problem cannot be solved by any one group of people, but requires the active work of all people. Here we are reminded that equity without intimacy leaves us back at square one. We have to know each other, love each other, and desire each other's well-being for any of this to matter at all. Last week, we considered how a life following the trajectory that I just laid out, calling out original sin, responding with urgency, and claiming intimacy with all of humankind, no matter the cost, well, that just might get you killed. We acknowledged that dreaming this big is not without suffering. So this week, we finally get to the dream. Or to use a fancy seminary term that makes us feel smart, the eschatological vision, i.e., the way things are supposed to be when Christ makes them new again, i.e., the place, the landscape, the dreaming that all of King's wondering and working bring him to, the zenith, the apex, the mountaintop, the place where the glory of the Lord shall be revealed and all flesh shall see it together. And it is a powerful, resonating dream, one that conjures within us a deep faith in a world reconciled and made whole because we have chosen to help make it whole. Because we have reckoned with the blood on our hands, the violence in our hearts, the sins and sufferings of our forebearers and of ourselves. And I'll go ahead and say this is also the place where we can really derail Dr. King's entire theological project if we aren't careful. We do this when we proof text, or maybe better put, whitewash the whole front end of the speech. That's why I spent so much time on it this morning. Only replaying the dream part, maligning the trajectory of King's message, and pretending like we've reached the dream in what we like to call a post-racial world. If you're a fan of the show Black-ish, you'll remember the widely acclaimed episode Lemons that dealt with the aftermath of the 2016 presidential election as it threaded Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech throughout the episode's plot. And if you believe in the inspirational work of the Holy Spirit, you'll celebrate with me how, as I was taking a much needed sermon writing break this weekend, sure enough, this episode was the next one queued up for me to watch on Hulu. Thank you, Lord. In this episode about a Black family making sense of life in America today, one of the four children on the show, Junior, and his grandfather, Pops, struggle to make sense of how to read and interpret King's speech today. What is the dream today? As student body president, Junior has been asked to recite the dream speech at his high school as a way to unify people after a, we love this word, right, divisive election. While Junior is practicing this famous part of the speech, Pops walks in with a revelatory piece of information. I have a dream that bloody, bloody, blip, blip, yada, yada. You know this I have a dream stuff is not the whole speech, right? Junior, surprised, says, it isn't? It most certainly is not. There's a whole lot of that speech that they do not want you to hear. And when I say they, I do mean the white man, if I was not clear. As Junior pulls up the earlier parts of the speech, the pieces we've been dealing with these last weeks, it hits him. And there will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. Oh my God, you were right. That's a battle cry. Junior asks his grandfather, why don't they teach us this part? And he replies, because it's their job to pacify you. So I won't pacify us today with a dream, because the imagery that King conjures of the children of former slaveholders and the children of former slaves sitting down at the table of brotherhood, this imagery of little Black girls and white girls standing together in the halls of sisterhood, this imagery is far from pacifying. In 1963, it would have been blasphemous, dangerous, exquisite in how radical it really was. This portion of the speech, this whole speech, King's vision for America, for all of humanity, is far from pacifying, though it calls us to peace. See, the biblical image Dr. King chooses to elevate is no accident on his part, even if it was extemporaneous, as we just heard. As a good student of the good book, King quotes the gospel writer Matthew, who is quoting the prophet Isaiah. Here in God's utopian vision of justice, where resources are distributed equitably, peaceably, and most importantly, joyfully, the valleys had to be exalted, and the mountains had to be made low. This is a geographically and cosmically disorienting and reorienting dream. It involves tangible change. It involves tangible action. It involves tangible love, love with some meat on its bones. See, this dream, the one that King boldly imagines with us, involves a cosmic reordering of the whole earth. The tectonic plates of history and time must shift in response to this dream. And the landscape of our imaginations and our policies and our economies actually have to shift with them if there's any dream to talk about. If my metaphorical language and allusions are not clear enough, yes, I'm talking reparations. Financial in nature, no doubt. But not just financial. I'm talking transformation too. I'm talking about a whole society of people celebrating the opportunity to set things right. Celebrating the opportunity to set things right. Not because shame has led them there, but because the joy of the Lord has led them there. Talking about a whole society of people celebrating the valleys being exalted and the mountains being made low. I'm talking about that check King said he came to cash at the beginning of this speech. And I'm talking about a country that can't wait to cash that check. Because they realize that holding on to it is destructive to their souls and demoralizing to their futures, to our shared future. I'm talking about a people who are ready to dream with God far beyond retribution and dues. I'm talking about a people who are ready to dream with God about restoration and responsibility. I'm talking about a people who don't need to extract certain lines out of King's speech because the past is too hard to swallow, but who open their hearts and their arms to the whole story. And the whole story is what keeps pressing them toward Easter. See, we can call the dream a reality when housing policies that discriminate against Latinx and Black people no longer exist. We can call the dream a reality when poor white folks don't buy into the insidious lie that their poverty is the fault of Black and immigrant folks, and they join hands and hearts to build economic justice that includes them too. We can call the dream a reality when we no longer incarcerate more people than any other country in the world, disproportionately Black and Latinx folks. We can call the dream a reality when we no longer need to hide behind the optics of diversity on college brochures and in office boardrooms because we've actually helped create diverse, equitable, and healthy communities. We can call the dream a reality when queer people in the U.S. and Nigeria and Brazil are claimed and called beloved by both the church and the state. We can call this dream a reality when we treat dreamers demanding that their parents' journeys to this country are celebrated as courageous and not maligned as illegal. Make no mistake about it, this dream is radical. This dream is cataclysmic in scope. It is transformative in breadth. It is immersive in depth. It seeps into every crack and crevice of our lives and our imaginations. And it is the most beautiful thing we could possibly do together. It is the most beautiful thing we could possibly do together. And we must root this dream in a dream that goes far beyond our individual imaginations. I can't see this by myself, y'all. Neither can you. Dr. King couldn't have imagined a dream like this if his mother hadn't imagined it first, and her mother before that, and her father before that. King is sitting inside a dream as old as Isaiah's. Later in the episode of Black-ish, Junior is ready to take on the world. He refuses to pacify his school with some sappy version of King, so he's decked out full Malcolm, ready for the revolution. And his grandfather stops him even after he was the one who told him the truth about King's speech in the first place. Now look, there was something I didn't tell you about the speech. When Dr. King was giving the speech, he was fired up. Now, there was a famous singer named Mahalia Jackson sitting right there with Dr. King. She screamed at him, and she said, "Tell them about your dream, Martin. Tell them about your dream, Martin." Mahalia had heard Dr. King speak in church a few nights before. She heard the speech, the part about the dream. She was moved, so when Martin heard her screaming, he knew immediately what she meant. The people needed to hear that we should be fighting, but they also needed to hear what we should be fighting for. They also needed to hear what we should be fighting for. Martin knew that. You need to know that. And you especially need to know it with where we are now. Look around you this morning for a hot minute, if you so dare. Look at the potential utopia sitting in these pews with you. People who, in their fullness, in their embodiment, in the story that has brought them here, in their beauty and complexity, can walk with you toward this dream. If you want to know what gives me, at this point, any ounce of hope about the dream, it is you. That's not just a nice thing I'm saying. It is you. You, in all your glory and wonder, are the dream. If we ever forget that, if we ever forget why King wanted the valleys to be exalted and the mountains to be made low, for the plates of time and history to shift, if we ever forget why we are doing this, we've hollowed out the dream and left ourselves with nothing to animate us and give us hope. So look around and look deep, beloved ones. This is the dream that we are fighting for. This is how the glory of the Lord is most certainly revealed.